Thank you, Dr. Vasant. And I was asked to speak very loud. My teacher was one of those fellows who spoke like this. I, Paramahamsa Yogananda, I'm talking to you now! And that's the way he spoke. So you had enough volume to listen to what he was saying.
Can you all hear Dr. Adan?
Good. So I'll give you enough volume.
Thank you for being here. And all these wonderful people who made it possible. The subject of Eastern or Asian ideas influencing Western men really began at the World Parliament of Religion when Vivekananda came to this country. Actually, that's the first real interest. And from that time on, Eastern ideas have been brought across to the West. I don't know if you've ever heard of Vivekananda, but he preceded another person by the name of Paramahamsa Yogananda. The reason that influence is moving westward, because we in the West have grown up to a Christian heritage, and many of the ideas that we ingrain in our thinking seem to reach a sort of dead end in the intellect. It doesn't seem to go deeper. Then we ask ourselves the question, where do these ideas really go? What are they really doing? Are they really transforming anything in us as human beings? And then we find Eastern ideas having another depth, something that was missing. And we question the possibility, is there more to the ideas that we've accepted? Could the ideas that we have accepted really have some source that they originated from and moved westward? Yes, there is a source where these ideas really move from. And it's man's own basic search for himself. The Western world came after Columbus, years after the man Jesus passed out of the body. And the Eastern world preceded Columbus, and the Middle Eastern world preceded Columbus. They rose to a point of intellectual and spiritual caliber and dropped right down to the bottom end of violence. And so, tracing back through that lineage, those who are looking for a deeper meaning for the ideas that they have inherited from their parents and their belief systems begin to see a connecting thread going all the way back to India. The very earliest writings that are recorded by men called the Vedas, we don't seem to get around it. Seems very strange that we have to go all the way back to that point of reference. Yet those ideas.
We want you to project a little bit
more. Okay. Those ideas are becoming more and more involved in our daily lives.
what has these ideas to do with our daily lives? What is appearing in research and those who have made any tangible experience with it find that the root of the idea is neither east nor west, but the terminology to describe the idea is east-west. The Eastern man used his terminology to describe the idea, and then it migrated westward in his language and was left to be explained by the transporter. Now the Western man hears the idea and it's alien to his thinking. And yet when you explain it in his terminology, he said, oh, but I live with that all my life. As if it was something there with him all the time. I'll give you an example of an ancient idea coming from the east to the west. You hear it today, wherever you go, the word karma. Right? It sounds so, that doesn't sound English. And then we have people to interpret it to us. What is karma? They say, oh, that's what you did, you're going to reap it. And it's action, reaction. And if you look back at the idea itself, every parent is telling a child, don't do that, you're going to get that. Be it an Eastern parent or a Western parent, you know that children can't assume responsibility for their actions when they're growing up. Be it an Eastern child or a Western child. And the first example of an Eastern child or a Western child performing an action after it's born is, you recognize this object? Piece of chalk, right? If mom and pop left it in the cradle, or in the hammock, or in a little shanty bag, whatever it is, and walk away, the child will do like it. Right? Be east or west. And so, very fundamentally, that would make the child sick. East or west. And then the parent will have to take the child to a shaman, holy man, and here over here we take him to the doctor, the pediatrician, and try to get the object out. And then the caution comes. You see, we told you to watch the child, make sure he doesn't do these things, and every action will have a reaction, now he's sick. That's the consequences of it. Right there, as we keep growing up, our parents try to inform us of certain actions we should perform in order to be healthy. But you and I know, as soon as you leave school, you're going to go against what your parents tell you to do. You may obey them up to a certain age because you don't want to incur too much financial stress on their lifestyle. But as soon as you leave school and you're on your own, you're going to go and do your own thing. Well, there's no difference between Eastern man and Western man. Eastern man did just the same as much as Western man is doing. The boys grow up, they go off, and they have to experiment, action to reaction. But in a language structure like the East, not speaking English, they use the word karma. That's the karma. That's the behavior, that's the reaction. Well, in the time of Jesus, Middle Eastern period, he used the word, as you sow, you reap. Do you see any difference to the idea? But if you're speaking in Hebrew, that will puzzle you now, because you speak English and he was speaking Hebrew, or he was whatever the language he was speaking at the time in his particular area. Yet, he used
a way to describe the action in an agricultural context. Do you see the agricultural context? As you sow, that you reap. You can't plant tomato and get corn. Obviously, it's not going to work. But let's say for one moment, you plant tomato and you get corn. The very first time you did it, that would be miraculous in your life, a fantastic action of nature. Everybody will come and see this wonderful experience. Then when you plant the corn, you get oranges. That'll freak you out because you can't rely now on what you're planting. You plant the orange and you got squash. Then there is no order anymore. So by the same token, the law or the idea and its mechanics would have to synchronize. When Yogananda was alive, he used to say, if the experiment, after it's finished, don't synchronize with the theory, the best thing to do is junk the theory and keep the experiment. At least you have the factual thing to work with. So idea, or the action, now has some way to come true. Well, we are taking these ideas, and like I say, karma, it comes on to the West. And not too long I heard a cowboy singing a song. It's just old karma coming down. What we sow, we reap. More and more we're realizing that the idea is not individualistic. It's a universal principle of nature. You can't get something from nothing. It's just the fact that nature decides this object has to have two ends. And therefore, no matter how I shrink it, even right to the middle, and it were to interface and disappear into itself, my brain would not quit thinking that those two ends are there. So if, as a human being, no matter where I come from, what genetic background I have, or what education I have, it will not quit thinking those two ends are there. So this migration of ideas and terminology westward has been the influence. And so what we're looking at today, in today's time, is all these ideas are laws of nature, the laws of the cosmos. Even when my great friend in past time, Dr. Newton, lying on his back and he saw the apple fall, and he worked out the laws of what? Action and reaction, right? And then Einstein came along and said, everything is relative. Good. Back in the East, that word relative is called Maya. Now, if you were living and having this word Maya, M-A-Y-A, impressing its influence on your mind, you wonder what they're talking about. Illusion, delusion. The same principle of the two ends. You can't have a one principle. Now, let's go back to Hebrew thinking. In the scripture it states, come, let us make man in our own image and likeness. Male and female, create he them. Do you see any singularity in that statement, or you see plurality? You see two things. Us, is that singular or plural? Plural. That's a fact there, right there in the idea of thinking. Be it spoken in Sanskrit, or spoken in Hebrew, or spoken in English. The us is plural. Our own image. Alright, so the two must bond into one. And likeness. So that is both an image and a likeness, a quality. A form and a quality in the form. like the oil in the seed. You don't see the oil right away when somebody hand you a nut. But if they say there's oil in it, you're going to question the idea that oil can be in a nut. Your brain won't let you rest. So you go prove it to yourself. There may be oil in the nut. When you get it out, then that's something you have to confront you. Image, likeness. Male and female. Without a mother and a father, I couldn't be here either. And I'm not two ovums, neither am I two sperms put together. I'm an ovum and a sperm. Like it or not, I'm stuck with it. So that's the very core of my structure, and the language is the problem to explain it to somebody else. Yet I'm not a loser. I'm a winner because I'm the only sperm that got through to become the living creature or form. Therefore, when you look at yourself in this room, there aren't no losers here. Welcome aboard, winners. And that's what your health is, the fact that you made it. Now, East or West, it's the same. They have to come to that point of acceptance. But they use words to represent all these natural functions. Now coming westward, and we have Western terminology for the same result. So we can look at things much more objectively and not be swamped with a guilt complex that most of these words tend to produce without understanding them. All right? Here is an object, a singular object, with two ends. No matter what I try to do with it, it will always leave me thinking of duality. Now we go to the Chinese and their concept of duality. They put it in terms of yin and yang. Sounds familiar to you?
Yes.
All right. Now, in Western terminology, it will have a certain influence in us, yin-yang, yin-yang. Sooner or later, we're going to have to find a word in English to resolve our anguish. So it ends up becoming plus, minus. Sounds familiar? All right. If you go to an electrical plug, we live with it. It's energy. The Chinese say yin-yang of energy. And you pull out the plug, you're going to see two prongs looking at you. There's the plus pole, or positive pole, and there's the neutral pole. And then you come to look at your own bodies to see if this yin-yang, or plus-minus, or dual condition do exist. Well, we got two eyes, two nostrils, two ears, an upper opening, and two lower opening, and we're supposed to have an invisible one locked up somewhere inside of the head. As a third eye, another sense of vision, or coping or sensing the environment. Well, ancient men in the eastern part of the world and the Middle Eastern part of the world, they're looking at the same phenomena. They have two eyes, even though some have to pull up for facial lift. And after many centuries, it looks like that. And they got the nostrils, and they got the ears, and the mouth, and the other two optics. But then they also feel that when they close their eyes and don't fall asleep, something occurs, a sense of knowing, another avenue of knowing. Where is this avenue open to? So they will call that the third eye, or the Ajna center. And then they went to draw the Ajna center as two little wings around a circle.
And it has come down through many centuries. If you look at the wing caduceus of the medical profession, two little wings and a staff, and there are snakes wrapped around it. And let me say that came all the way down to us now, the profession, as it has a logo. What are they really telling us? That Eastern man stumbled across how to look at his internal anatomy minus telescope, minus microscope, minus x-ray machines, by slow withdrawal from the five openings of the upper part of the anatomy, the five senses, and try to go in to observe. But then, not too many people accomplish it. So it's not a reliable system when you're dealing with a lot of sick people around you. You need more, and therefore, Western man has evolved the actual equipment. And yet, though the equipment can see into the object and identify what is going on in the object, the Eastern man has seen the same substances and cataloged them under their terminology. We didn't find any difference in the geometry or recognition of the idea, but the language has become the stumbling block. What is the Eastern man saying? He says Ajna Center. Then you can go around in every look in every other language for, and lo and behold, Ajna Center turns out to be pituitary gland. Western men now use his terminology to identify Ajna Center as pituitary gland. Then when you take out the pituitary gland out of the brain, that doesn't say Eastern man didn't use to cut up and find out too, you know. We got enough vivisection being going on, cadaver cutting. So we're just as equally, but labeling again is the problem. They found that the pituitary gland has anterior lobe and posterior lobe. Two lobes, right? No more. So for that reason now, they can draw top of the caduceus or the logo a circle with two wings. And because it's up in the brain, way above your nostrils, anytime you inhale too much and you get hyperventilated, what happens to your body? You feel like you're gonna fly off your chair, right? Good, or you feel floating sensation. That's why they put wings. They could have put two hands or two noses or some other design. It's because what was experienced in early time to modern time, hyperventilation under certain illnesses created a heightening sensation in the Eastern country as they studied the phenomenon, especially in India, where the actual science of respiration was worked down to an actual science that today we haven't found anything other than mechanical compensation for what is going on in the actual science of respiration. All the basic rules pertaining to proper healthy respiration and the mechanics of it have been charted out in the Sanskrit language pertaining to the actual physiology. And now we come with equipment from the Western language point and we're gradually validating it. That's what is so interesting, that the real problem with ideas coming from East to West, the problem is in language, not so much the idea. It's just to be aware of what the language represents. So when you hear of an Eastern term used for a certain idea, don't get scared that you're not going to cope with it. You may understand it even better when you recognize what they're actually saying in the English language. Then you can work with both. I was fortunate in this way to have heritage of an Asian, Asiatic background, and a little of the Western Spanish in me. So I'm what you call a Heinz 57. I'm stuck in the middle there. So I can integrate between the two levels of thinking, which gives me a better insight to the language process and the understanding of ideas, how they affect us in our daily living. The predominant idea that seems to dominate from the east to the west is the word karma, action. Now, if you look at your scriptural writings, of all the three words that are more very dominant in the human life is thought, word, action. I can think all day and do nothing. I can talk all day and do nothing. But until I get up and act, nothing can be more factual to be measured than the action. So it doesn't say that East or West has any difference. It's a fact that action is a function for all men, regardless of where they come from. In the West, they say, put up or shut up. Familiar statement? That means act and quit your belly aching. In the East, they're going to tell you the same thing in their Sanskrit language. So then you begin to recognize karma, that's his karma, that's his action, that's the way he acted, that's what he's getting his own, he's going to get his own medicine back. And you begin to realize that action as an experience, and no matter what the language is trying to describe it, as far as the human being is concerned, what is this action primarily for? Be it East or West. Action primarily is for health. First, it is for health. The very action of a baby putting a piece of chalk in his mouth is going to make it what, healthy or sick? Sick, right, because that's where the, and so we have to watch from that level of action to the most mature level of action of the adult. And what are we really assessing between the Eastern man or Western man in his thinking? We are assessing action, how he relates to action with his words. Now, we're the standpoint, or I don't say standstill. I don't like to use the word standstill. That means nothing is going to happen anymore. We're a standpoint between the Russian and our American diplomat in their view as to the nuclear idea. It's going to be terminology we're going to be using to phase down or phase up how we act. You see it today in today's newspaper all around. Again, it's the way we talk, communication. So action is a measurement that you have, working your way back to word. Communication is the means of phasing down any violence in the action or any repercussion in the action. So you have to watch what you say before you act it. Here again, we haven't learned anything more from the process, the action, then we have to learn the communication or the word. Then we have to think up what we're going to say. How are we going to present the plan? That's where the thought comes back, or the idea. We have the idea carried through to the actual communication or blueprint or plan, then the action. When you look at the Eastern country, you see the same thing. Here's an architect living in India. Here's an architect living in America. They all both have the idea they want to build a house for their family. The architect will have to dream up by closing his eyes and trying to put his ideas of what a house represents.
And so he draws out the blueprint. And he looks at it. This is the drawing, the art form. That becomes the first actual expression of consciousness from the level of consciousness allows us to express. Impression, image. Come, let us make man in our own what?
Image.
The impression, the way it is going to impress itself. In the Eastern thinking, we haven't gone any further from that. The archetypal terms are there. The point is, after the image or the blueprint is drawn up, the wife may say to the husband, honey, do we have the money to pay to build a house? It looks beautiful, I love it. And the husband said, yes, when we married, daddy gave me a big, your daddy gave me a large dowry. And I inherited large inheritance from my daddy. And together now we will pool it and that will pay to get the materials to build a house. That hasn't changed in the Western world. Father-in-laws, mother-in-laws, they all give things to what? The intended daughter-in-law or son-in-law, right? So to get them going. So then comes, that's what we call the contract level, how you word this thing up to pay for it. You go in the bank and arrange, now I got this and I want to get that. Then when you have that ready and all straightened out, then the action comes. Get in the materials to break ground and put up the house. Good. The house is finished built. Beautiful house. Everybody is happy. But the architect can't tell his family, oh my gosh, what is happening to the house? The ground is moving. He didn't know an earthquake was coming. No matter how we can draw the blueprint, no matter how we can set up the contract and finish the end product, who is going to tell you that an earthquake is going to come along overnight after the finish is built, the building is finished being built, and going to rake the building down and tear it down? So that's a tremendous loss. Is there anyone in town that we can go to in the future, that when we spend all this time to foresee when earthquakes are coming or when large hurricanes are coming? And in the Eastern country, they call them seers, rishis, prophets, oracles. And what we got today? Weather forecasters. Any change in the idea process? Just migrating with the same conditions. And so over there, the wise man is revered. Why is he revered? With the foresight, the internal vision to encapsulate time, to allow the individuals to function harmoniously with what they have. Today we call them forecasters, to give us the edge against the weatheromics that could destroy us. It doesn't have to do with nationality, it has to do with the fundamentals of living. And the way we talk to ourselves, these ideas are going to be constantly be with us. But the language is the thing we have to understand. It's moving to this part of the world because the interest in the West for the East is expanding. We're finding out that the ideas are basically the same. It's the way we design them or the way we label them. But once we get over that, then we're very, very naturally relating. Now let's say for one moment, we hear the word Maya, which is the relativity described by Einstein. Has the Eastern man taken his ideas and put it into a functional science? with the label he uses, Maya, to represent flow and interflow. Versus Mr. Einstein's use of the word relativity and putting it into a rational science to demonstrate it to the Western man. Yes, because Eastern man, like Western man, is not going to swallow gullibly what somebody tells him without questioning, because he lives the same experience of putting out an idea, discussing it, and paying the cost to build it, and then falls down. And so, sooner or later, after many mistakes, he wants rational facts to work with. There is no difference. We're all going to be the same. Listen, my father used to say, there are only two words you got to know, son. How and much. How you do it, and then much more at the cost. So eventually we end up saying the same thing wherever we're going. Cost factor is an evident condition, but cost factor leads to scientific knowledge, because how would you build a house? And if you look at the Eastern architecture, they can't do it by imagination or wanton guess. You can't build a house in the West by guessing it either. There are laws that they were adhering to. They have to have measurements to work with. They have to have consistencies in various material to be used to get the results. And that is really where the Eastern men began to question many of the ideas that were used by the wise men who taught them. And the wise men began to teach them the actual physics of it. But because it was never published, well, that's one thing I prize the West here. We hear of an idea, and before you know it, the whole community knows it next morning. There you hear of an idea, it may take you 10 years or 10 lifetimes before the community knows it exists. And that's what the phenomenon is. The distribution consciousness. An idea, once it's discovered in the East centuries ago, didn't have a large distribution process. Whereas an idea today in the West, the distribution process makes it available to everyone. So when you look between the East and ideas are coming to you, and it's in the language you want to relate to, you'll find a commonality, a union, a recognition of something that is there, that everyone is partaking. It's in the language more than the idea. The idea is universal. It has nothing to do with nations or male or female. It has to do with the language, how we say it to ourselves and how we use it. Then that breaks all the guilt or being left out or being imposed upon. The way you talk about it, the way you narrate it. Relativity, stated in Eastern terminology, is Maya, illusion. Now, we in the West hear the word illusion, and right away we think of the carnival or somebody doing sleight of hand, magical tricks on board a stage. In the East, their understanding of illusion is not what we understand it to represent, that it doesn't exist. Illusion produces delusion. So when we say all this is Maya, and to interpret it as the word illusion, the human being can be fooled to believe, from an English heritage, illusion, and then narrate it or try to identify it with the carnival magician. As far as the Eastern man is concerned, no. This is an illusion. in the sense that it is not solid and consistent. It is subject to continuous change. And that what you are looking at can delude you any moment you don't focus accurately on it. Einstein comes along and proves the same thing. This is a relative universe. And relativity is based according to light. Now, let's go back and see what the Hebrew man says. In the beginning, we heard of in Genesis, the very first command given, let there be music. Oh, light. Then the place was all dark, right?
Right.
Good. Then is the light faster than the darkness, or is the darkness faster than the light? I don't hear no answers. But if the darkness was there and the light came out, which one moved faster to allow the other one to appear?
The light.
That's your illusion now. The light pushes its way through the darkness, and the darkness would have to move faster. Now, because of that, time warp exists. So modern astronauts now are dealing with a time warp, because if you see your movies, how do these fellows slip through and get out from one range of light to the next? The time warp. But we didn't realize that centuries ago, but the yogis realized that. That means the unified mind. That's where the word comes, yoga. Unified mind. Today we have unity church, universal thinking, union, or unified field again, Einstein should say. So you begin to recognize what you're saying to yourself in the unified field. This is possible. The fact that darkness moves away to allow the light to appear, darkness would have to be faster and diffusing out itself with the light. And that's the delusion now of the illusion. You can be deluded. So we say, when a man shows you an egg in this hand and everybody sees it and then he does like that and it disappears, did the egg really disappear?
No.
Right. But because they say the hands are faster than the eyes, you get deluded. Now, if the eyes were faster than the hands, you couldn't get deluded. Equally true. If you could focus the eyes, and that's where the microscope will do, the eyes of the Eastern practitioner, called yogis or yoga, centraling or focusing, they now control the focus of the shift of light. And that's what the meditational techniques have been developed. They're means to arrive at the focusing of the control of light over a mass. You are looking at this object. And yet, at the same time, you're looking through the object, right or wrong? Huh? Isn't that a strange phenomenon? Now, you're looking at this object, but you can't look through it. Now, what is it that the eyes is doing? Is it seeing or photographing? Ah, you see, now that's a fact. Because it's photographing, the ancient man came across this phenomenon by closing his eyes and looking in. And that was called the unified consciousness. He's unifying transparency with non-transparency. And modern science has come along with equipment to separate the two, to allow us to look at it. But in a vaster quantity of people doing it at the same time than just one fellow doing it all by himself. That's the only difference. Here we have a piece of equipment that everybody can look through and see. And then we have to rely on one person looking, yes, I see so and so and so and so. And then you have to write down what he says. And then you may walk away out of respect for him and say, yes, I'll do what he says. But deep down in your heart, you're still doubting it. Whereas with the microscope, he doesn't have no personality, or he doesn't have personality, and it shows you what the object looks like. So you're going to have to decide right or not to do it. So when a doctor looks inside and says, I see you have a bacterial on the top of your nose, you better do something about it. You can't waste time anymore. Say, I don't believe. So the person who uses his inward vision to see the same bacteria at the tip of your nose, you might not want to believe him. Though he may be classified as a yogi in the Eastern terminology, or a yoga therapist, in the West he's classified as a doctor with a microscope. All he's doing is unifying the fact to validate that there is a bacteria on the tip of your nose. The unified consciousness is pulled together by equipment versus the unified consciousness pulled together by biological organs of the anatomy. So when we realize what these men are saying, then we are no longer trapped down. We can then take control of ourselves and understand the language. And it's relativity is based on light. And the energy, they say, that's the formula, because it has to have to do an energy field, is equal to its mass, that's the weight, times its velocity, the speed that it's going to travel, of light. The only object that they are phenomena of this vast illusion. Though it's empty between the two, there are teemings of forms moving there that the eyes, per se, at a point of focus, cannot see. Now, the conditioned eyes, which they call the unified conscious focusing, or the yogic process, is a measurement of looking there. And yet you take the microscope and or telescope or whatever equipment you want and measure, you will start seeing objects there. So this is the difference between the two cultures. But basically what they're trying to do is look at that invisible space and identify what's in there. The approach may be different, one using his eyes from inside and one making an equipment to validate. And the terminology that they're using. But like everything, we're human beings. We're prone to have what is called a veneration complex. We'll always venerate those who go ahead of us. And when you graduate from this university, you're going to want a piece of paper that says this diploma grants you the right for having done the many requirements. It doesn't say if you pass the A, B, or C, but it belongs to the University of Arizona or whatever country or state it belongs to. That's the veneration pattern. So that is what led to all the various conditions that have gone up in the East to today. A sort of veneration. But we can get carried away with it and be fanatical. And that's what they call now the bhav, the Sanskrit word, the deva, the seva. Now those are words that sound so odd and strange to us. Yet if I said it in English, that's the love that emerges from your heart for the fact that the people in this building or institution spent their hours coming here every morning and hammering away at this blackboard to get you to retain the data to go take an examination and get that piece of paper. Sometimes they really don't want to come here. Right? They're what you say, teed off. And if you've been a teacher, you know too. And if you've been a parent, you know. You can be pretty teed off. And that's the bond, that's the love. But compassionate nature, you go on. The saver is the service. You're going to maintain the service because why? You can't lie down and die. Be you East man or West man, you can't lie down. So you pick the choice of serving either for reward or no reward. And that's where we are right
in our own thinking. The word seva is service. But then the question is, what type of service? A service with reward or a service with no reward? With reward, that is an occupation. No reward, how many people will perform service for no reward? Unless he's a politician who will take $1 a year to sit there and perform as a means of saying he is performing service for the community and extending his qualities there to enhance the society. And that is, so a non-reward service is seva at its maximum understanding. We call it the charitable or the non-profit attitude. That means, we put it in an English terminology to represent the same idea of performing a service where you don't do the service for any gain. We are saying that to ourselves, we are doing it. And yet, in the East, we say, the man is practicing seva. Now, don't get me wrong that everybody is practicing seva because he's practicing it. You can be fooling yourself too. Seva is devotional service, first without a gain to yourself. You have to decide you don't want no gain. Without to the community where you want to extend it because you feel the urge to help your fellow man. And also, it is to the whole of life. It's a selfless service. Now let's look into the Hebrew tradition and see if we can find such a phenomenon. There's a story that the man Jesus taught. If you remember the Good Samaritan, that it sounds familiar as an idea, then the context of the idea. He came along, he saw an ill man, but those who preceded him saw the same sick man lying there, and yet each one had his own version of why he wouldn't do something for the man. One said he was not of Mike's group or brotherhood or union or whatever. And the other one says, well, I wouldn't have anything to do with him because may not be speaking my way of thinking. Yet the Samaritan, all he came along and he saw a human being that was ill. He didn't allow his Samaritan heritage or his language to interfere with the fact that that's a human being, not of the same culture, but just a human being lying there ill. He reached up, picked him up, took him into the town, made sure somebody take care of him, and told them to give him the bill when he passed through. And that is what we come back to now as seva. In irrational everyday living, you don't go around boasting about it. You don't try to make an issue of it. It's the fact that whatever you see that is rational going on around you, and the attitude of a human relationship, you reach out and do. To the Eastern thinking, this is the word seva. In the Western world, it's called charitable action. And not too long ago, I was driving down the road and I saw a bumper sticker that says, faith, hope, and bumming. Faith, hope, and bumming. They might have used the word bumming, but they are getting something for nothing. But that's not a healthy attitude, to say you want to get something for nothing. The concern for your fellow man in whatever level he is a healthy part of your inner nature. But for him to believe or live with the idea that he's going to constantly use that as a means to get something done for him, is sickness. And that's not healthy. It is how to get him out of that state to accept himself. You may help him out of his dilemma
by giving him something to eat, get him back to look decent and to work, but not to drift back into those thoughts that will leave him again totally helpless to himself. That's not a healthy state for that person. And in the East, they have places like Dharamsala. Now that sounds a very strange word. In this part of the world, we call it non-profit charitable organizations. Have we changed anything? So, Salvation Army. That's Dharamsala for you in the Western world. They come along, the Red Cross, all these people are doing the same ideas to the terminology. Okay, relativity plays a very important part in our lives. This so-called illusion of things around us, nothing is fixed. If everything was fixed, from the day you're born, you wouldn't grow 1 inch. It's fixed. See? And that's not possible. So everything is changing. But we can be so fixed with the idea that it's not going to change that we can hurt ourselves. And so the Eastern man had to find a word to break that condition, and ending up having thousands of sick people all around them. The kings couldn't afford it. They don't have welfare programs in those days. So they had to get these wise men to find a way to get these people to stop being so fixed in their thinking. So they made an issue of the word karma. They used that as a sort of a, what a teacher would use when a child disobeys her, she may knock on the table and says, "Now listen, and if you don't, you go in the corner and sit down there." Karma then became the psychological ruler of chastisement to get the individual to focus on his well-being. For every action, there is an equal reaction. What you sow, you reap. This became pronounced in the minds of people now, to get the people off from the welfare consciousness or the so-called something for nothing attitude, because the kings couldn't afford it in those days. Today we've got a big stockpile, but we aren't doing any different. But we got to get off, and therefore all the wise men zeroed in to teach the conditions involved in karma. If one lifetime would resolve all the karma of a human being from the time he's born to the time he takes responsibility of his life, it would be very, very wonderful. But one lifetime doesn't seem enough to resolve all the mistakes you've made. So wise men have decided that either you face your fellow man and confront the situation openly, or you may have to pick it up in another life form, because you may die from the ill effects of the results of the repercussion of the action, and you would have no place to take care of it. For example, in the Garden of Eden, there was Adam and Eve. Then came Cain, the product of their union. Then came Abel. Cain is supposed to kill Abel because of the preference that the creative intelligence showed over the two. Now the question goes, no man lay a hand on Cain. Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. Abel is dead, literally. Cain is walking around free. No man lay a hand on this fella, and cosmic law is going to provide some way to compensate. Literally, now if you ask yourself, as Abel, when will ever I catch up with this guy to give him a punch back in his face for having done me in? And the other one is busy walking scot-free, and no one is supposed to hurt him. Now, imagine life can't end. The human body may lie down and die, but life don't end. Because when you are connected to the umbilical cord, before they cut it, you put it on a scale and weigh that floating fetus. It'll weigh one measurement. The moment they cut it and it breathes air in, it will weigh another measurement. And from then on, it will weigh that added quantity of weight in the form. Now, before you die, you may weigh one measurement. And when you die, you weigh less, that same quantity that came into you after you died. Evidence of modern physics. Ancient man told us a long time ago, you are the breath. You're not the body. In India, the science of prana, or the word prana, life force, the whole rational knowledge of respiratory control, is laid out as a factual science involving input, output, involving the constriction, dilation of the tissues. The air comes in and it forces the lungs to expand. Then the air goes out and the lungs constrict. Yet, in a strange way, if the baby does not retain the air after the doctor has cut the cord, and the nostrils are not responding, and they try artificial methods, which is another form of Eastern yoga methods, by they call it hatha. That's the word ha. Push in, out. We know that biological resuscitation methods, and we even go to the mechanical oxygen over the nostril to get it to breathe. Incubators, if it doesn't hold that oxygen, then we have a lifeless form. There we are forced to realize now that we are not merely the physical frame. We are that oxygenation principle that goes on at the time the cord is cut. If we realize that this oxygenation doesn't die, and that this oxygenation produces the phenomenon called consciousness, because when you're sung to sleep, though you breathe, are you aware that you are conscious? Sung to sleep? Do you know if you're a man or a woman when you're sung to sleep? Only when you wake up and you look in the mirror, it's me, all right. Yet, look how critical it is that when you're sung to sleep, you don't know who you are. By the same token, this body isn't giving you any guarantee from any part of its anatomy that you're going to wake up tomorrow morning when you go to sleep. Eastern men, Western men, yogis, I hate to use the word hippies, but, or whatever you want to call the person who wants to find a different way to his environment, revolutionaries, none of us have a guarantee till we come to grips with what we actually are. And so the ideas that are coming from the East to the West the medical profession is slowly sorting it out, and we are getting a better understanding of these ideas and the mechanics of it. And it's just the language that separates. It's not the principle itself, it's the language. We don't have a guarantee we're going to wake up. And yet, you all woke up, including me, this morning, because we all went to bed and we preset our brains to do what?
Get up.
Ha ha ha. Isn't that amazing? You talk yourself into reality. And so the wonderful man who wrote the book, Positive Thinking, was very accurate. And years ago, when I was struggling to develop my memory, and then I found out about Casey putting the book under his head and remembered what he woke up next morning, I said, no, I combine that with my own statement to my mouth, to what I'll say to myself before I fall asleep. Lo, my memory began to work for me now. I had to program it. So programming from within is repetition to get the thing to work again. Cause and effect is the karma, and yet the programming is the recurrence. Now Cain is going to go scot-free. Abel is never going to catch up. Maybe when Abel was clobbered by Cain, he said, I'll get that guy, and he went on dying. The body may have been left there, but it's a consciousness that thought pattern left unfinished. Can't. No one surrenders his life that easy. No matter how you are hurt by someone, you always got some innate desire to do what? To make it even, right? To put it back in balance. So that particular predominancy is locked into the life principle and sets the what you call now the next level of Eastern ideas that have come to this part of the world, reincarnation. Another chance to confront the issue. Another chance to face it and resolve it. Now let's go to Western thinking. If you fail an exam and the teacher says you can't come back in this class because you failed, it's the first time you took it, you failed, that's over. That wouldn't be fair to you, because that's not giving you a chance to what? Make up for the deficiency. But if they say, okay, but you got to go back where the new students are coming in the same class and go over and take the exam and then pass and go on. Isn't that a form of redoing, reincarnating it? Good. Hebrew thinking had the same thing too. Jesus, the man, walking to the River Jordan, saw another man in the river, throwing water on other people's head, calling the ceremony or the ritual baptism. And Jesus looked and all around and said, there is no man born of woman, and he didn't say Jew or Arab or all the different, there is no man born of woman. That's an overall view of the total perspective of this understanding of what he said. Greater than John, and he points to the man who's in the water, baptized, who is Elijah that has come. The church has been trying for years, not a Catholic, I confronted my mentor at the time about that same statement. For years they've been trying to evade or close down on trying to interpret that to satisfy the continuation of their ideas. But we can't get around who is Elijah and who is John. John is in the water. Jesus is standing up making a statement. Who is this fellow Elijah? And where is he coming from? That's the context of the formula or the equation or the problem. If you want to, let's tear it apart and see. Don't feel that you're threatened by it. Look at it objectively. It's in a Hebrew context, brought all the way westward by the Romans to modern America. And here we are looking at it. No man born of woman greater than John. who is Elijah that has come. Unless the person has the inner memory or recall, he couldn't identify that person standing there and label it a name that the very people knew lived before. Those people knew Elijah lived before. They have records of his existence. And he's pointing out, the present man is pointing out to the other living men that that's Elijah. Now, that's the point of where the church could not eliminate that part of the belief system or the actual laws. We are forced to live the actual laws in today's time. Why? Because you get up as a child and you look around and your parents may take you from one part of the United States to another part of the United States, and all of a sudden you recognize something about that area that is totally different to your parents. They've never been there, yet you come in with them and suddenly you find something that you can pinpoint and say, I know this, I recognize this. And the mother and father says, nonsense, kid, you're crazy, you got to go see a psychiatrist. Have you ever run into that situation? Many times. We, not only in here in this part of the world, and all over, they're running into it. The continuation of life and the thought impressions on the memory bank can't be erased. Even modern science now with their equipment have found a talking skull. I don't know if you read it in the newspapers. The skull that is giving off data. They're puzzled with the fact that where are these ideas left? Where are they going on? I'm talking sonics. Is it going away because you don't hear it no more? Has it gone into nothingness? No. The yogis have been saying for centuries in the Eastern terminology that sound is the source of the universe. Hebrew writers have said, especially John, in the beginning was the word. What is a word? It's a sound. If I don't make a sound, I can't call it anything, right? But if I do call it, you will integrate with it because you've been programmed to accept the sound, and therefore your brain will match it, and then you'll say, yes, that's the right name for it. Now, to show you, if I call this penknife, and you'll be accustomed to calling it a fountain pen, you know penknife don't match, right? Automatically, the brain is going to reject. You want pen. That's the same principle going on. In the beginning was the word, the statement, sonics. The whole environmental field. Let there be light. Which came first, the let there be or the light? The let there be were words written before the actual condition light. This is the next word, right? So light came after darkness was already there, but out of the darkness, sonics declared, let there be light. How can we go around this actual laws of ourselves, be it Eastern, using the word shabid. That's their term for the sound, shabid. Our term is sonics. We break word. In the beginning was the word, and the word was with God, was. What tense is that? Yes. Interesting phenomenon. It's not a present tense. That means it's there and we're emerging to recognize it. And the word was God, not is, was. It's already done, put the thing together. And the word was made flesh. Am I flesh or am I wood? I'm flesh. Therefore, the next sentence makes all the difference. And dwells in man.
It doesn't dwell here, though you heard a sound, but that sound cannot integrate to itself. It cannot talk back to itself. Adano, listen to yourself. I can talk to myself. I'm inside. I can correct myself. I can improve myself. And I can get on with the rationale of active living. Do you see it now? And then the yogis will come along and use their terminology of shabd meditation. That is, focusing, meditation is focusing internally on the sound, audible life currents in the physiological makeup of the body. And this will give you liberation from your limitations. All right? The shabd is the sound. Sonics will give you liberation. Mr. Caruso made it, and a piece of glass broke. That's a fact. Then he took off his high note, that glass broke, and here is sonics from a human being snapping an object in the environment. Now, if we can organize our sonics we can regulate our health, our emotions, our intellect, and all the basic functions of the organism. It makes more sense to you now? We're saying the same thing. Now, reincarnation is a condition of unfinished ideas that must be resolved someplace, sometime. We have to resolve it. There's no way we can get around it. Cain will have to face Abel sometime. And Abel's got to face Cain sometime. They're going to face it off. They may not kill each other the second time when they confront each other. They may have a good tussle out in Madison Square Garden and walk off, one the loser, one the winner. But they're going to face it. Because they have to resolve it at some point in time. As we evolve more to allow these laws to work their way out, individuals are facing off their past memory levels. Now in the Jewish thinking again, there's another statement. To him that overcometh, I will not send forth a second time. Are you familiar with that statement? It's in the book of Revelation. To him that overcometh, I will not send forth a second time. But I will make him a pillar in the house of the Lord. Biblical writers are inferring that somewhere along the track of time, if you overcome your confrontations and straighten it out between you and another person in the now time before they die, you may not have to come back a second time to face that situation. Otherwise, if you don't straighten it out, how are you going to resolve it? Cain didn't straighten it out with Abel. He went and killed his brother. And therefore, Cain will have to experience a second time to confront Abel. And Abel will come back. Yeah. So we realize now that when the Eastern man was recognizing this law, and he used his terminology to describe this actual law, he used the word reincarnation. It is not an Eastern idea, neither is it a Western idea. It's just the fact, a natural law of nature. You don't get something from nothing, and you can't pass from one grade to the other if you don't fulfill the requirements. It's just that way nature is. And the more you come to grips with it, the healthier you become. The main purpose of all these ideas from migrating from east to west is to give you a greater grip on your life, a greater grip on your sense of being, that you can work through the limitations of yourself with your thinking, with your speech, and with your action. So don't feel you're victimized or you're a victim to reincarnation. You're not. It is at that moment in time when you recognize where you are, you can take those innate qualities that you brought from parental and from education and apply it to resolve the internal conflicts to give you a sense of being. I'll quote another example of reincarnation and what awaits the person. We are not limited to reincarnation. It's not fatalistic. So don't feel threatened by the fact that you have to come back to face something. It's an opportunity to wind up what you haven't resolved, but it's not fatalistic. The example I'll quote is, there was a blind man brought to Jesus. And they asked him, whose sin? Did the man sin that he born blind? Or did his parents sin that he born blind? Now, if the man sinned that he's born blind, and if we don't believe in reincarnation, how could it be the first time and for them to ask such a question? Here he is born blind for the first time. He never came here before. He's going to go no place after he leaves here. Then why ask the question, if he sinned, where would he sin if he never came here before? And he's born blind. The laws of physics will show you. You'd have to precede before you can have a condition. You'd have to done something before to have the condition of blindness. If his parents sinned or did something wrong in their lifestyle and he's born blind, that's heredity. Well, heredity simply means if the mold has a crack. And I passed not too long ago down that area where they're making lovely artwork. You're going to have cracked products, right? The mold is cracked, the product is going to be cracked. Till you correct the crack in the mold. But the answer that the teacher gave in reconciling the thought patterns was needed. Meaning, he didn't perform it in a past existence, and he didn't reap it from the parent. But it's the next answer that gives the freedom. This is to the glory of God. This ideation or release pattern is a built-in process already locked up, and therefore you went ahead and healed the man. I'll give an illustration. You see this object? Look where it's going. That's the normal predestined area, right? To drop into this hand. Right? So by the law of cause and effect, it must go there. There's nothing else for it to do but go there. So even Newton would be saying it's the law of gravity, right?
Yeah.
Okay. No. It's not going. What's happening?
No letter.
But I'm still letting go first. That is a compensatory action built into the law of reincarnation. The compensatory action is there, a plus, a minus, a neutral. We have that as grounded electricity. Thank you.
We have time for a few questions from the audience. So if you would like to ask Dr. Ray some questions, You're more than welcome. Any questions? Yes.
What was it just saying about the compensatory reaction? I didn't understand.
This is a built-in action in the law of reincarnation. It's called compensatory in that it intercedes. I'll show you a compensatory action in modern thinking. You drove a beautiful car to come here?
No.
No.
No car.
All right. But the person who drove you in that car would not go down the road without his spare time. That's compensatory already in the car. Do you see? It's built into the process. That the four wheels are there, and any mishap may come along. It runs on four wheels, but if there's a mishap in the way, there's already a built-in compensation that you can go and take the spare tire and put it on. Equally true, though you may make mistakes in your ignorance and finding your way out through life by trial and error, there is a compensatory action of those who are watching you and are more alert that they can intercede and guide you out of it. That is why we don't have to suffer the consequences all the time.
What was the word you used for the glorification of God? Lila?
Lila.
That's a Jewish...
That's right.
What is the word?
Lila.
Lila. Lila is a Sanskrit word.
It's also a Sanskrit word too.
It's a Sanskrit word. It means the play of divine action.
That's right.
L-I-L-A. L-I-L-A.
Now you see in the East and in the Mid East and in the West. Now...
And you are for that position to say Nila.
Right, exactly.
It's in book 6 of the Bible, by the way, about the blindness and about the glory of God and why the man was born to serve again. And to by serving, to bring out the glory. That was the purpose of that whole chapter in the Bible. Any other question anyone has?
Well, you said something about meditation or chant. I mean, I heard that you told me that a sound. Is that the use of chant to heal or to...
When you chant, you are consciously focusing sonics on the environment to correct the kinesiology or the weakness in the body. Therefore, if the environment is very tense or stressful, by the focusing of sound through the voice, you can correct that particular condition. By the same token, in meditation, you may have mental turmoil, and you may not be the type who wants to get up and sing. Therefore, you may mentally listen to your own mechanics of your body making its own humming. Now, if you're very tired and you close your eyes, the body has one tone. If you're very excited and you close your eyes, the body has another tone. And if you're very happy, nothing bothering you, you close your eyes, the body has another tone. The more you can identify with the tones of the body or the internal cellular humming in the state of mind you're in, the quicker you can correct a lot of your problems. And that's what they call the inward meditation or listening to the audible live stream. Now, some people can't do that. They don't find us. They can sit down too long. So they get up and say, glory, glory, hallelujah, and then they feel relaxed and they get back and go to work. That is just as valid as Do you do that when you wake up and roll in the bed sometimes? That's exactly what we're talking about. Learn to use sonics at the internal level or the external level.
Thank you very much.